So I'm going to talk today about something that I don't think you've covered in this program yet. I looked through the lectures online, and I know that my postdoc, Carlos Badanis, talked a lot about using X-ray data to understand things about the explosion mechanism of 1As. What I want to talk to you about today is something that goes beyond his work. He was thinking about it in a first step, a 1D calculation. And so I just want to show you some results from an observational study of supernova remnants with Chandra, and in particular of the Tycho supernova remnant, in which we get at the inhomogeneity is on a spatial as a function of position in these remnants. So I just want to go very quickly through how we would type remnants, type supernovae from the remnants. I can skip through this, everyone knows it, but maybe I should just go through it quickly. there's a class of remnants in which the optical spectrum is purely Balmer dominated. There's only H alpha lines in the spectrum. And it's believed to come from partially neutral ambient medium. Bob was one of the people who helped understand and explain it. So that has been used to classify type 1A remnants. Another classification has been the lack of a compact remnant. Obviously, that's only down to some limiting flux and some wave bend, but one can get interesting limits nonetheless. The X-ray spectrum has been used in a while, and this was what Carlos talked a bit about. And here I show spectra from an old satellite. This is OSCA back in the mid-90s, where we were able to first get CCD-type spectra that gives us the ability to resolve silicon, sulfur, argon, calcium, and iron lines from continuum and other emission. This has got a complex fit to here. We didn't have good spatial resolution. But nonetheless, the fit we had allowed us to draw some conclusions, or so we thought, about the composition of the ejecta. And here I plot as a function of, this is the different species, relative abundance to silicon. It's hard to tell, but generally you get a lot less of the low Z elements, oxygen, neon, magnesium, and a lot more of the high Z elements. Okay, and so generally there was consistency with the ejecta modeling that we did with the spectrum and what were predictions from the W7 model, except for iron, where the iron was much, much lower in the data than we expected in the model, and that was claimed to be evidence for stratification. And again, Carlos talked a lot about that, and he has very good data for that. The X-ray structure, I think, is something that hasn't been fully explored, but you know, whenever I show these pictures, this is a 1A remnant, or so we believe, SN1006, this is Tycho, and it has a real fluffy, fleecy kind of interior structure, whereas G292, which has got a pulsar in it, and so the product of a core collapse supernova, is much more structured. There's very dense knots of ejecta, and lots of other features in the X-ray and optical data. And then, of course, CAS-A also is highly structured. This hasn't been quantified yet, but the idea that the 1A remnants sort of are evolving more in a uniform interstellar medium, so they're sort of smoother, their ejecta is also less subject to instabilities, perhaps, and then there's modest spectral variations. And of course, 1.4 solar masses of ejecta is a very important, would be a very important key if we could measure the mass from the ejecta. And then in what's a very nice development, which I'm sure you've heard about, it's taking spectra of light echoes will actually allow us to have a lot of confidence about the nature, the actual typing of the supernova. So I just want to show you a couple of examples and show you that we think it kind of works, this technique of going through the remnants and looking at their X-ray properties and kind of seeing if we can draw conclusions about them being 1As or not. So this is a remnant in the Large Magellanic Cloud. Don't worry too much about the name. And here it has a very nice outer shock that here is shown both in the X-ray data and then there's an optical image too, which I put in red here. And so any place where it's very white means you've got contribution from the optical emission as well as the X-ray emission in a broadband sense. The blue here is actually the hardest X-ray emission, and in fact it includes things like silicon emission and sulfur emission, stuff you might expect from a 1A ejecta. And in fact, it's pretty clear that you've got this interior component of metal-rich ejecta surrounded by an interstellar shock in which you see both the X-ray and optical emission. This is a middle-aged remnant, about 4,000 years old. Spectral analysis of the X-ray data gives us LMC composition for the rim, and that's sort of the type of fitting we're doing. Whereas the core, if you model that with a simple X-ray spectral model, and you try to estimate the ratio of iron to oxygen, you get something that's very high, very iron-rich. And that's shown here, the spectra shown here. Oxygen would fit in this region. You'd see an oxygen line here, which is basically what you're seeing in the rim spectrum. It's cool in the rim, I mean, relatively cool, a kilovolt or half a kilovolt. So you get a lot of oxygen, 7 oxygen 8 emission in the X-rays. You just don't get that in the center because we believe it's because the composition just doesn't contain it. Instead, you get this broad blend of emission here, which is iron L. And so it turns out that the most useful or the best way to actually constrain the mass of this stuff is to just do the dynamical model. Use the locations of these shocks, the location, so the edge of the outer edge of the ejecta, and something like a hydrodynamic model, like something by Truelove and McKee, for example, is very good, was what we actually used here. You can constrain the mass of the ejecta to be something like 1.5 solar masses. So I think I'm pretty confident that this is a 1A remnant at sort of middle age. And there's more than that. There's other examples of this in both the galaxy and the LMC. So this sample is growing. We have of order half a dozen or so. And every time we image a new remnant, we kind of look for this and allows us to look for a sort of an iron or silicon-rich core. And in fact, we can also do it for core collapse. We do occasionally see central components that are oxygen-rich, and that sort of signals that we have a core collapse supernova. So can this work for young remnants? Well, this is a young remnant that actually Bob and I worked on 10 years ago, where we first got an OSCA spectrum, and we actually claimed it was a 1A remnant from the integrated OSCA spectrum. It's a young remnant. It's less than 1,000 years old. This is only about, this is only a couple of parsecs in size, about 30 arc seconds. So it's just at the edge of resolution for Chandra. There's only, say, 30 resolution elements across there. It has a light echo age. It's about 400 years old. This is the spectrum. It's got a lot of, it's got a lot of iron ale, lots of silicon, very strong silicon. It's very round. And we actually got an HST image of it, which is actually gorgeous, and unfortunately I didn't put it on. So we did a spectral analysis before for Tycho, and in fact what we find is that the oxygen and magnesium is much less than the middle Z elements. This is a comparison here, the low Z elements, the high Z elements. Again, we have a deficit of iron, which again we argue is consistent with a stratified ejecta. We argue that the elemental composition here was more consistent with the delayed detonation model than, say, W7. But I think to really confirm that, we need Carlos to do his detailed modeling on this, and he's working on that with us now. So we think it's been kind of working. But again, this is the integrated spectrum, and I just mentioned the large gap here between the model. Right. Okay. So the view, thank you. The view you should have is that there's stratified. The ejecta is stratified by composition, and you can think of it broadly as three separate zones. That's sort of how I think of it. Sort of an oxygen unburnt, oxygen carbon unburnt stuff, and then sort of silicon rich stuff, and then a really iron core where it's all iron. So if that stratification exists and remains through the explosion, then as a reverse shock propagates through it in the X-rays, you'll successively light up more oxygen-rich material, more silicon-rich material, more iron-rich material. And so ultimately, when the reverse shock goes through everything, it all should be heated to X-ray emission, and so you'd expect to see mostly iron. And that's what we think we see in DEM71, the first case, the middle-aged case. In this one, we think we're getting deep into the silicon-rich zone, and so the composition of this stuff is consistent with what we see in the oxygen. Okay, so the oxygen-silicon ratio is what we think the models give us when you integrate over everything, but the iron's much, much lower. So there's a lot of cold iron as a reservoir in the center of the remnant that hasn't been shocked. We're not seeing it in the X-rays.
So if you predicted then what the timescale would be for the interior to light up, and then you compare it with the age differential,
yeah, well, in that case I told you before, where we did this dynamical modeling, because we used the positions of the forward shock and the contact discontinuity as inputs, we then had the reverse shock come out of the model, the location, and it already, and according to the models, reverse shock is already into the center, so it's thermalized the whole ejecta. So from that very first order point of view, I think it is working in DEM71. And Carlos is able to get a pretty good fit for his stratified 1D models for this remnant. Fitting effectively to the spectra that comes out here, and basically being consistent with the production of the amount of metals he's getting with a stratified ejecta. So that's basically what it is. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about his work, just one sheet on that. So I've been working a lot on 1006. I'm sorry, what am I saying? 1572, Tycho, here he is. This explosion was first sighted in Korea and maybe in Spain in November of 1572. And it was brighter than Venus, visible at noon for those gifted with a keen sight. Tycho observed it on November 11th. So he wasn't really the first one to observe it, but he did it after dinner, so he's working hard. You know, it's good to see. He carefully measured its position. This is a plate from his old, his original measurement. And there's the supernova. I'm sorry? My sources say he was after dinner. Okay. Well, you know, I had this whole quote, which I go through when I give a colloquium on this, and it's really very funny. And it's taken from Stephenson. And it says, I was perusing the skies after dinner. So anyway, we can argue about this later. It's a very substantive issue, Bob. Thanks for raising it. So for those of you who can see Cassiopeia tonight, go out and look. You won't see it. That's where the supernova would be. It was discovered as a radio source in the 50s, faint center filament, H-alpha filaments, and lastly as an X-ray source in 67. I should say it's now an infrared source with Spitzer. Anyway, the remnant center is actually within 2 arc minutes of the position that Tycho gave, which is right in the middle of the remnant. The remnant's 4 arc minutes in radius. So pretty good. So here's a modern view. This is the radio data from the VLA. This is an H-alpha image. This is the only band in which the remnant appears in the optical. Lots of stars, but just the H-alpha emission only comes from sort of this northern region. This is the X-ray image from 0.5 to 7. And what's really, really kind of neat, there's a very nice Spitzer 24 micron image of this showing very interesting rope-like features. Personally, I think this is mostly from the interstellar medium, basically just morphologically, but people are working on this, and I await the data they get. In any event, the only place where we actually see eject is in the X-rays, and so I put this color picture up. This green shows where the silicon emission is, which is correlated well with the sulfur emission and some other species. This red shows where iron emission is, and this is where I'm going to start to get into this idea of spatial inhomogeneities. And then the blue is non-thermal emission from shock acceleration of diffusive shock acceleration, accelerating electrons up to 10 TeV energies. So that's a whole other talk, which is a fascinating paradigm-shifting result from Chandra that I don't have time to go into. But anyway, Carlos has done a lot on Tycho, modeling it as a 1A remnant, and he built a code that does the spectral modeling, taking 1D realistic ejecta models and evolving them in the interstellar medium, including things like compositional stratification, density stratification, the velocity profile for them. And he evolves them with a uniform interstellar medium. And then he actually compares his model to X-ray data, the XNM spectrum. And I'm using it from the western portion of the rim, which is where the uniform, where the emission is more spectrally uniform. And he really only has 3 parameters: the density, the ratio of collisionless electron heating at the reverse shock, and then a column density, the column density of absorbing material to the remnant. And then he also has to include a continuum model. And these are the sorts of fits he gets. This is a good fit to a delayed detonation model. It's really quite good. He fits all of these lines in their relative intensities without varying any abundances. This is purely based on the input from the explosion model. And he gets the centroid of these as well. The iron K is most sensitive to the ratio of collisionless electron heating at the reverse shock. Then he also, and so then this shows the continuum model, which is all from this non-thermal X-ray synchrotron emission. And this is an example of a bad fit, which is one of those mixed 3D models. It doesn't get the line fluxes right and doesn't predict the continuum well at all. So why are asymmetries in 1A remnants interesting? Well, why is it interesting and useful? Well, you know, when you have any single individual 1A supernova, you really only have a single sight line to it. So you can constrain models that are axisymmetric or multidimensional or whatever only in a statistical sense in the ensemble. You don't really know the sight line to any individual supernova. But with these remnants, number one, we knew they exploded. They were successful explosions. So that is good for the modelers to know that they actually exploded. They're optically thin, except perhaps in some of the very strongest resonance lines. But if the gas is turbulent, that may not be as important a problem, important an issue. They're generally optically thin, and that's what we assume. They're spread out geometrically, as you can see. And we also can have the potential of light echoes to actually confirm the 1A origin and, you know, perhaps going a bit of a step further, maybe subtyping as a, in the 1A classification. The remnant evolution is governed by hydrodynamics, which is pretty well understood. We have complications due to shock physics, electron-ion heating, and cosmic acceleration, which influences the forward shocks evolution. But they're actually amenable to X-ray observations, and if we could get many existing observables on, say, the line ratios at much higher resolution, like from ConX, then we could do really amazing things. Just slight advertisement. Slight advertisement there. Yeah, you know, along the spread of light curve width. No, I don't know now. But the problem is that the light curve, the echoes are actually the average spectrum over a period of time when the remnant was very bright. So one would need to work very carefully, you know, one would need to do the right averaging of classes of spectra that we have now. If we had ConX, I wouldn't be worrying. The worrying's a step earlier than that. Seriously, though, at 5 arcsecond resolution, you can resolve this thingy. Okay, so this is 8 arcminutes across. So 15 arcsecond resolution is going to be okay for this object. These are on the scale of 10 to 15 arcseconds. So. Obviously, having 1 arcsecond resolution with Chandra is spoiling us, but we're also spoiled by not having a lot of photons, and also not having the dynamical information. I mean, we were hoping with Astro-E, before the XRS spectrometer died, to actually measure the center of the remnant and look for the splitting of the lines from the forward and backward expansion of the remnant and get a direct velocity measurement. We're going to have to wait on that. So anyway, I want to take a higher resolution view. Here's Tycho. Here's this iron knot. I'm going to talk a lot about this. There's also some iron emission that you see in here, sort of reddish glow in here. There are large-scale variations in the iron emission properties in the isolated clumps. Here's this other remnant in the LMC. It has an iron-rich region. Here the iron is green, I'm sorry. And then it has a little eye here. If you imagine this, it sort of looks like Pac-Man, for those of you old enough to know that video game. Sort of an eye there. And here the iron is red, sorry. So this is that knight. This is this knot in this remnant here, UL509. There's a little spectrum of that knot there, that bright knot there. And it's not. Unfortunately, you don't have a lot of data here. It's pretty faint. But this is if we take a spectrum that fits basically the rest of the remnant, and doesn't do so well. If we increase the iron by about a factor two, we actually get a much, much better fit here. So our conclusion is that little eye is actually an iron-rich clump with something like a factor of 2 more iron. So it's not a pure iron clump. It's a clump of iron that actually has mixed composition. So this is Tycho. This is data from XMM. This has been published by Andrew Korshel. And these knots on the outside here, which you saw were obviously different color with a lot of iron in the middle one here, they were actually first discovered by Vancouver et al. In 1995. And Andrew Korshel did a very nice spectral study of the region here, these three spectra here, finding how much the abundances vary. So this C2 is this iron-rich one, and it has a very different ratio of silicon to iron compared to the other knots around it. So I've gone into some detail to actually really look at this issue in some gory detail, and I'm going to go through that with you here. This is the broadband Chandra image. If you take the ratio of the band where the silicon emission is and the band where the iron is, you get something that looks like this. If you highlight it so that you're displaying the silicon-rich stuff, you actually see little knots of silicon-rich stuff all around. And then if you display the iron-rich stuff, you actually are dominated by this stuff here. You have a few other places where the iron seems to be intense, but nowhere near as intense as this. This is a band image. So in fact, what you're picking up is some of the continuum. That's just this non-thermal continuum. I didn't subtract that out, but there is continuum emission in there. So what I do is examine the spectra of several knots down here. Sorry, it doesn't really show, but there's a set of knots down here I just examined. And I plot them here. Now, for someone who knows X-ray astronomy, these are very unusual spectra. These are the iron-rich ones. This band, this big, broad band here is the iron alum emission. It's really quite strong in these remnants compared to the silicon. At least a factor of 2 or 3 higher intensity than the observed silicon line emission. And this is what the silicon rich knots look like. As you can see, the iron is much, much weaker. So, and here from our spectral model fits, we get silicon iron ratios that are of order 0.3 in these knots, and in these knots are of order of 10 to 20. So in fact, if you take the highest and the lowest, there's a factor of 60 or so variation in the abundance among those knots along the edge. Just by looking at the silicon line itself and measuring its intensity with respect to the continuum, its equivalent width, you can demonstrate that these are all ejecta knots. There's no interstellar stuff at all. It's dominated by the ejecta. So we need a factor of 60 range in the silicon iron, but we don't have pure iron or silicon knots. That's very interesting. Unlike in Cas A, where we actually see pure knots of iron and much knots with no, that knots that we can trace back to different nucleosynthesis processing. So we have silicon burning that goes almost complete exhaustion to iron, and then we have other cases where we're left with a lot of silicon from oxygen burning. But here, though, we have this huge range in silicon to iron, but no pure ejecta, pure metal composition. And so what we did was to look at W7 and say, well, where could you actually get that range in silicon? So here's the iron, ultimately going to decay to iron, and here's the silicon. So it's in this range here where you can actually get a factor of 60 difference in the iron to silicon ratio in here. So for the longest time, that was sort of the explanation for these knots, that it was just some instability that drove so that we're seeing some sort of iron-rich knot from here.
What fraction of the material is in this
room? I'm going to get to that at the end, okay, because it's not a lot. It's small. So, but the problem with that interpretation, in my view, is why do you only get this one clump here? Okay, and so what I'm going to go through is try to explain to you why really, how confident I am that it really is a unique system over here, iron-rich stuff. So what I show here is the iron K emission. This is from the hot iron. And what you see is that the iron K knot, so these knots on the edge here, appear as iron-rich in the hot iron. So they're pretty hot. But the rest of the remnant has this shell of iron emission, which I've traced here with this dotted curve. Well, we actually fit the location of it with the solid curve, but then I just traced it with a circle to show that these knots are morphologically quite distinct from this ejecta emission, So the picture we have is that what's happening up here is that we're seeing the iron that's naturally in the core of this 1A remnant as a reverse shock is propagating through it. There's silicon emission, which appears outside it, and so we have a nice argument for the stratification along here. But in this case, there's really not that situation. We have just these iron-rich knots right out front. And this is just a schematic to show you that how we determine the location of the shell-like morphology or demonstrate the shell-like morphology to this direction. This is just the sector across here showing the surface brightness as a function of position, and that's sort of our shell model fit to it. It's really pretty decent. There's a lot of coincidences here, and that's what I'm just bringing up. It's very interesting to me that there's this edge over here that is distinct morphologically even in the single band. I'll show you that there's actually an axis along this direction in which composition varies, other species' composition varies. So I don't have an explanation for it, but it's something that I think would be relevant to modeling. So, the detailed multidimensional supernova modeling. So I'm going to give a digression on principal component analysis because what we want to do now is actually be analyzing comprehensively this data we have from Chandra. And the only way to do that is to look at the whole data in a statistical sense. And so we've developed this, we've applied PCA to the remnant data. And here's some reasons for doing it. The basic idea is that you have, for example, in this case, two different measurements of some quantity, say the height and weight of people. And they're highly correlated, and so you can it really only depends on one parameter, maybe BMI or something, and so you can actually take your data and define a new set of axes in which you maximize the variance in one direction, minimize it in the other direction, and so it's an eigenvalue problem, and it's turned out to be quite powerful for data of for Chandra data. So what we do is to take the data, here's the image, and we divide each. We divide the whole data set up into a large number of spatial regions, And each spatial region is supposed to contain a certain number of counts, so we get a certain reasonably uniform signal to noise across the remnant from a spectrum point of view. It turns out we have about over 4,000 spectra that come out of this process. We also bin up the spectra as well, and we bin the spectra into 12 spectral ranges that correspond to interesting spectral features. For example, iron L emission, silicon K emission, interesting continuum emission to diagnose where the cosmic ray accelerations are, cosmic ray electrons are, and then iron K. And so, in fact, what we have is we have 4,000 spectra that have 12 spectral channels. And so what you should imagine is that we have a 12-dimensional space representing the values that each spectra have in each of these 12 points, okay? And we have over 4,000 points in that 12-dimensional space. And now we're looking for directions in there. We're looking for a way to rotate an axis, set of axes, into that space to maximize the variation in that data, in that huge cloud of points. Maximize the variation and then choose the next orthogonal point that maximizes the variation in the direction and go through until we get a set of rotated directions. Is that clear? I mean, that's I know it's quick, but it's sort of really typical just PCA. Now, the point is you get these new axes, okay, but there's no guarantee that those axes and those directions have anything to do with astrophysics. They're just purely mathematical at this point. I have put no astrophysics in other than the binning of the spectrum. So you can imagine that what you get out of PCA is just the value, so you get a set of eigenvalues and eigenvectors, and you can then project your data points into this new rotated space. And when you project into each of those spaces, you can then plot the distributions of. So what I plot up here are the distributions of all those points into the first four principal components, okay? And so this is the number of regions, and this is the value of the principal component, the projection onto this PC1 axis. So this is the projection. And you can see there's a whole cloud of points here, but then there's a distribution tail that goes off to very large values. So this is clearly a significant signal, and I show sort of a noise peak here in blue. This is what we'd expect the noise peak to be. And so it's clear that we have the noise distribution is in red here. So the noise distribution, just based on the Poisson noise in the data that we know very well, gives us a very narrow width here. So this is a very significant signal, PC1. There's a lot of variation here. Okay. PC2, again, has an asymmetric tail, the negative values in this case, and it has a red component here, a noise component, which is, again, much narrower than the data. PC3 is now becoming much more symmetric. It's a symmetric distribution. And the red noise curve is is still narrower. So there's a signal here, out here. Okay, so PC3 is significant. PC4 is not. And all the higher order PCs are not. The noise and the data have exactly the same width. They're symmetric. And so we've actually figured out a stopping criterion here. So PC1, 2, and 3 are significant. The remaining are just noise. Which, if you've done PCA, you know that that's not easy. It's not easy to come up with an algorithm for stopping conditions. It's very hard to stop. So here's the first principal component. This is that image of Tycho, and what you see is that the component differentiates between the blue emission outside and then the darker emission interior. And you note that the PCA doesn't make any distinction between these different colored thermal knots. So the picture really is that what we're seeing in the blue is non-thermal emission. And what we're seeing, and that's the lighter region out here, and then the darker region interior is thermal emission of any kind. So it's really the difference between a featureless spectrum. And so what I show here is some example spectrum from regions with extreme values of PC. Yes, exactly. Exactly. You're perfect. You're excellent. Excellent. So this tail out here represents that outer rim. Okay. And this tail, if I may speak ahead, this tail represents the red iron knots. All right, so the blue spectrum here just shows you the most extreme case of the spectrum in one direction of PC1, and then the red shows the extreme spectrum in the other case. And this is, for those of you not familiar, this is a spectrum dominated by a hard continuum emission, synchrotron emission. So that's pretty clear to someone who works on these data. And spectral fits confirm it, detailed fits confirm it. And then the red stuff is stuff that's really rich in silicon and sulfur. So this is really thermal ejecta. The second principal component now picks out the iron-rich knot here. And then it picks out the region here where we think we're getting iron emission from the reverse shot propagating in. And again, you see the spectrum where these are, again, the red and blue represent extreme spectra. They have the red region here, lots of iron out, and that the blue region has a lot more silicon than iron. So that's consistent with this region being the iron-rich stuff. And, okay, so now we actually have a comprehensive picture, right? So we can actually look for places where, elsewhere in the remnant, where we actually see this value of PC2 indicating higher iron. Okay, and so I've magnified or I've zoomed that particular principal component image, and you know I basically burned these regions in. Okay, so these really are very iron, the very iron-rich region, and then there's just a few individual little knots sitting around here where we have approaching the same kind of level of PC2-ness, extremeness. And here's a spectrum from those knots, all fit with silicon to iron abundances that don't really approach the level we have here at all. Factors of 5 to 10 off. And so what we can conclude from this is that these eastern iron-rich knots are morphologically distinct. They're the only iron-rich knots at the rim. You go all the way around, and there is nothing that comes anywhere near having the iron-rich nature of these. And now they're also spectrally distinct. You consider anywhere in the remnant, nothing has the same iron-rich stuff. So the fear is that, well, you're just not seeing these ones when they're projected in the middle of the remnant that are coming toward you or away from you. But this this analysis is supposed to demonstrate that that's not the case. That these are really spectrally distinct, and we would have seen them if they were in the middle. So I'm sure you folks all know this. As an accreting white dwarf approaches the channel-like mass, it starts to smolder, and the ignition is supposedly occurring somewhere near the center. And then you get the sort of a spark, hot, a hot bubble of iron-rich ash, buoyant is a simulation from the flash center. And it's not clear how many bubbles are involved, but the process is essentially multidimensional. So I'm sure you all know about this as well, that there are certain supernovae that show the high-velocity asymmetric calcium emission. Also, spectral polar mirabilis indicates significant asymmetry. Here's a particular model from the Kazan and Flua, the flash center, showing the asymmetry they get in their particular model. Some estimate of what the light curve should look like. I'm sorry, that was a spectra. This is the light curve. And so my question to you is, to the modelers, is if iron-rich knot, is this a spark from the ignition of the SN1A explosion that formed the Tycho supernova? It turns out it has a mass of about 3 times 10 to the minus 4 solar masses. So it's small. I mean, so it may not be I don't know what the Plua model needs, but it needs a significant amount of iron to in the gravitationally confined detonation, much more than that. So this is clearly just a small amount of iron, but regardless of whether it actually formed the ignition, was the origin of the ignition, if it was a spark from the ignition, it gives us a unique insight into that process. And so my real interest is to try to nail what the composition of that is. How much iron is there? How much nickel is there? Do we see chromium? What is the ratio to silicon? And actually provide some input to people who are modeling what these sparks do and how they evolve for the star. So am I way over? Because I can go into another section.
How much more do you have?
What number is this? I have about five slides left. Okay, all right. So that was the second component, and it's about these iron-rich blobs. And now there's this third component, and this is a totally new component. This has never been seen before, so we're really excited by it. And the main difference, so this it shows a large-scale asymmetry, okay, in an axis that goes along this direction, okay, and it mainly is a difference in this low energy band, although there's also a difference in the higher Z elements here, which I'll get to in a bit. But the bottom line is there is the spectra contain less emission below 0.7 keV. Up here, there's less emission in the soft band and more emission in the hard band here. So there's sort of a gradient across the remnant in the properties of this soft thermal emission. Shall we discuss it all now? Yeah, I'm going to go through the whole the range of interpretation. So the interpretation of PC3, this is the eigenvector spectrum. Okay, so it's sometimes easier to look at this because this is actually what came out of the PCA. So this is the lowest band, and it's anti-correlated with a band here that contains, and this band contains oxygen, this band contains sulfur. But anyway, let's go through it in order, all right? The lowest energy bin, as Roseanne said, could it just be a variation in interstellar column across the rim, global variation. Well, it turns out that we know that there's an H1 cloud that people claim Tycho's interacting with, but it's off toward the northeast, so it's actually up here. And so you might expect an axis of column density variation in this direction, and what we're getting is in this direction. But nonetheless, we looked at the question and we asked, well, how much column density do we need to have varying across the remnant in order to explain this? And it turns out you need to have the column density vary by a factor of 2 from over a much, much larger range, far larger range than we see when we actually fit the spectrum around the rim. And there we get the column densities almost the same across the whole rim. So it's very unlikely that it's a column density effect. It's also the soft range, so it could be that there's a soft thermal emission that somehow is appearing, more or less soft thermal emission across the edge, across the remnant, like from an interstellar component. I haven't talked at all about an interstellar component, but it turns out that we don't see it directly because the non-thermal emission from the synchrotron electrons overwhelms it. But we nonetheless looked at what happens if we added a soft component. And what happens is you really can't explain the full range of PC3 that we see, the full range in that distribution. And part of it is because that PC3 is a symmetric distribution. If you add another component, you're only going to change from the mid up to the high or low values. You're not able to actually get a range. So we don't think that a soft thermal component is going to do it. And so we looked more carefully at this eigenvector, and we found that we looked and said that this band, which contains oxygen, is anti-correlated with this band, which contains the sulfur emission. And so perhaps it's abundance variations. We looked at that using the distributions of points onto PC2, PC3. So I just showed you the 1D distributions before, showing how the data are distributed in the one-dimensional projections. Now I'm showing you a projection into the PC2, PC3 plane. This is the PC2 value, this is PC3, and I got all the points from my spectra, and then contours showing where the points are, where the distributions, this is like, I think this is 90% and 68%. And what I show on here are tracks. So I have 3 different tracks here. We've actually done spectral fits where we know what the spectrum looks like from the mean spectrum, the average spectrum across Tycho. So we have a good spectral model for that. And what we've just done is allow the iron abundance to vary and put a track down here to show where those models would sit with different amounts of iron. So in this case, with no iron, you're way up here. With lots of iron, you're down here. And so that doesn't actually match the direction of variation we see in PC3, so that's not going to be the full explanation. If we let oxygen vary, that's the green curve, okay? And even if the oxygen go to 0, we don't get the full range down here of the PC3. We get, you know, if we increase the oxygen, we can go way up here. And then if we, the final thing was, based on looking at the correlation in the eigenvector, we allowed oxygen and silica and sulfur to vary independently. And sure enough, we can get the large range that we expect. So it looks to me, it looks as if that by allowing oxygen and sulfur to vary in an anti-correlated sense, we're actually able to get the range of variation we need to explain PC3. So we then went off and we chose spectral regions, and actually from XMM, which gave us a lot more statistics than the Chandra data. Turns out PC3 is visible, and it comes out in the PCA, an independent PCA of the XMM data. All of these components come out, which is a really amazing thing to me, but you know, if it's something real, it should come out that way. So I have 2 regions here, those that correspond to the PC3 positive regions in the remnant, and I got a spectra from a range of regions there, and then a range of regions where the PC3 is very negative. So those represent the outliers in the PC3 dimension, PC3. And I fit them to the same kind of models I've been using, letting the abundances vary. And I'm plotting them again, as I have with oxygen and whatever, all normalized silicon. And the bottom line is that there are variations in the abundance ratios that are consistent. The ratio of oxygen is between the positive and negative is about a half, while the ratio of sulfur and iron is about a factor of 1.5. So the detailed spectral fits basically confirm what we had suspected from the PC3 and looking at the tracks, that PC3 positive and negative represent the difference between an anti-correlation in the abundance of oxygen and higher Z elements. So let me summarize what we know on Tycho. So we have these iron-rich knots, which are morphologically distinct, spectrally distinct, and have a mass about 3 times 10 to the minus 4 solar mass. That's probably uncertain to about a factor of 2 or so. They're unique in probably, we're pretty confident that even viewing in projection and overlap, that these are in fact unique knots, that we don't see anything anywhere similar to these across the face of the remnant. This is this variation in PC3 composition. And this direction indicates a direction where the oxygen abundance decreases, whereas the sulfur and iron abundance increases in this direction. So the question we have, which we haven't answered yet, unfortunately, is whether this is a variation in the ejecta. Does it represent perhaps a thinner oxygen region here, so we see less oxygen, thicker oxygen region here? Or could it just be that the interstellar medium is denser here, and it's propagated through the, and that we're getting an excitation effect that's different on either side due to a difference in the interstellar medium density. This is something that we're working on using Carlos's models to see if we can get something that's consistent with an interstellar interaction or points more toward an ejecta interaction, something fundamentally different in the ejecta. And so the idea that this, you know, there is this remarkable axis here, I think, that comes out in both the morphology of the iron K, in the existence of these knots, and in now this coordinated composition variation. And so the question, do we see it in other 1A remnants? Well, I mentioned that we saw this iron blob here in the eye. The mass is about 6 times 10 to the minus 4 in this Magellanic Cloud remnant. This is 1006. We don't see any iron. It's very, very little iron, very little hot iron. There's no obvious blobs. This is a very strange spectrum. It's very rich in oxygen. Kepler, it's hard to tell. We don't see it in Kepler. And this is another LMC remnant that's sort of a twin of this guy. And we don't obviously see blobs. But these two haven't been analyzed in the great detail that we have with this one. So anyway, I just think there's a, I believe there's some interesting physics that we can glean out about the 1A ejector properties by studying these X-ray remnants. Thank you. Yeah, I worked very hard to make sure I got the variation of oxygen in the right direction, because you're right. It is consistent with there being, let's see. So the point is, there's going to be there's less oxygen up here, and perhaps more silicon and sulfur. But it's really a global variation. You know, that's the thing. It's much more of a bisymmetric thing than.
But if you have an asymmetric explosion, you create sort of a smooth asymmetry in the density of the material, like when you're burning, right? And you have some sort of global, you know, you have a change in direction, and you create a global asymmetry in the density structure of the white dwarf, you know, when you burn. And so this can create a nice smooth variation.
So you're saying this might diagnose more the density structure than necessarily a composition structure.
Mm-hmm.
No, you're absolutely right. The density is going to interact with the hydrodynamic model of the remnant. Absolutely.
No, he's talking about the density of the remnant.
Okay, right. Right, the pre-expansion business.
Yeah.
Sign right. So, which side, the oxygen-rich side?
Yeah. This white is more oxygen-rich.
The right side?
Yeah. The place where you're. necessarily should be 3 to 10 more. So it should be
lower than that. Have to be 10 to 1 to 1.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the oxygen
is just going to be.
But we both have to get it right, so it's only 1 in 4, right? we don't have any polarimetry on this because the optical data is just that H alpha emission from there, and it's just a remnant emission. I don't think we're going to get spectral polarimetry from the light echo either. But that's interesting to think about.
Yeah. So how long do you think a bright cast would have been for a shot to see this? I mean, how thick is the shell? Does it stay bright forever after the original shot comes through? Or does it stay bright for a little while and then fade? I mean, are we looking at a shell or really everything outside of this?
No, this is pretty much a shell, because I showed you those shell model fits. So this is a pretty good shell model fit. Well, we did that whole paper on that. I don't exactly know the numbers, but it's about, I'm thinking it's maybe 15% of the radius, 15 to 20% of the radius is the thickness of the ejector shell.
The mass of the clump is just the mass of the stuff that's settling it up.
Yes. It's total mass, including all the composition, few tens of the minus four, solar mass.
So what's the mass of the stuff that's put up in the shell?
Well, that's, for that, one really needs, okay, the mass estimate I gave you, okay, is based on the simple, very simple models, emission models from these. So I haven't taken account of any dynamical effects, okay? The amount of emission I'm getting here, though, is very sensitive to dynamical and effects having to do with the collisionless electron heating. And so if I change that beta parameter, the collisionless electron heating, I will change the amount of matter inferred from there. So if I just take Carlos's best fit model, which are based on a segment from this region here, okay, he claims that about half of the iron has been shocked. Okay. That puts everything together. That's a dynamical model, fitting his, and then fitting to the spectrum, and including this beta parameter in order to get the iron line flux. He gets about a half of the iron has been chopped.
All right, so we need to break and come back in 5 minutes. Cool. Okay.